psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson, the voice you trust for the family you love.
If a father wants to get into his daughter's world, he has to listen to her.
This is, in my view, a battle where everything is up for grabs, including the very existence of this nation.
And I'll see this horse that all of a sudden looks over and says, oh, there's my kid, there's my kid.
This is Family Talk with Dr. James Dobson, along with Ryan Dobson and Luann Crane.
Well, Ryan, we're going to talk about human liberty on our program today, and I want to begin by asking you a question. I'm going to put you on the spot here.
Uh-oh.
This is a one-item test, pass or fail. Do you remember the primary reason the Pilgrims came to this country in 1620? What led them to leave the East Midlands in England for what became Plymouth, Massachusetts, and why did they start life over in the New World despite not only the inconvenience but the danger and the other trials that they experienced? Why did they do that?
Well, I think it was in the third or fourth grade that I learned they were escaping religious persecution and came to the New World to have religious freedom and freedom of worship.
Well, you're right on target, Ryan. You passed the test. It's why religious liberty is the most fundamental of all our freedoms, and why it must be guarded and protected, especially today when it is under such unrelenting assault. You know, we've seen the passage of hate crimes legislation this year, which threatens the rights of pastors and clergy to preach their interpretation of Scripture from the pulpit. I still can't believe that's happened, but it has. And, of course, we're now witnessing the courts striking down the expression of faith in the public square in numerous venues, including the district court judge in Wisconsin, who declared the National Day of Prayer as unconstitutional this year. And, of course, the war on religious freedom just continues on and on. It's gathering momentum throughout the nation. We did a radio program on that just several weeks ago. But now a new threat to religious liberty has begun to appear in the words of President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that has culture watchers alarmed. And I want to let our listeners hear what Mr. Chuck Colson said several days ago on what he calls the two-minute warning. We're going to play it again, but you can hear it on our website at myfamilytalk.com. Let's let our listeners hear what Mr. Colson said.
Hi, I'm Chuck Colson with this week's two-minute warning. If you read George Orwell's classic novel, 1984, you'll recognize the term newspeak. Newspeak was the language of Big Brother used to control people's minds. Newspeak manipulated words, changed their meaning, and even eliminated some of them, like freedom, from the vocabulary. Well, last December, Georgetown University Secretary of State Hillary Clinton delivered a speech where she ever so subtly engaged in newspeak, and I can only conclude she knew what she was saying. The speech was about human rights, and here's the heart of what she said, and I quote, "To fulfill their potential, people must be free to choose laws and leaders to share and access information. To speak, criticize, and debate, they must be free to worship, associate, and to love in the way that they choose." Just two sentences. Mrs. Clinton revealed the government's desire to diminish freedom of religion and elevate the gay agenda to the level of an inalienable human right. Yeah, okay, I can hear some of you saying, Chuck, you're going a little far on this one. I only wish I were. Twice in her speech, Mrs. Clinton referred to freedom of worship. But freedom of worship is not the same as freedom of religion, which is guaranteed in the Bill of Rights. Writing in the Denver Catholic Register, theologian George Weigel hit the nail on the head. Let me read it. "Religious freedom includes the right to preach and evangelize, to make religiously informed moral arguments in the public square, and to conduct the affairs of one's religious community without undue interference from the state." If religious freedom only involves the freedom to worship, then there's religious freedom in Saudi Arabia, where Bibles and evangelism are forbidden, but expatriate Filipino laborers can attend Mass in the U.S. Embassy compound in Riyadh. Mrs. Clinton was not so subtle when it came to the gay agenda. Is there a fundamental human freedom, as she claims, to love in the way you choose? No, not with incest, bigamy, and pedophilia. Nevertheless, as Weigel wrote, the promotion of the so-called lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered agenda had just been declared a human rights priority of the United States in the same sentence in which the Secretary of State offered an anorexic description of religious freedom. Look, the distinction between freedom of worship and freedom of religion is critical. Can you imagine a day when the government says to a church or religious organization, worship any way you want, but you'd better hire practicing homosexuals. You'd better buy insurance to cover your employees' abortions. And don't you dare preach that homosexual behavior is a sin. Well, I can imagine it. I'm also not surprised that the administration has yet to fill the vacant post of Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom. But it's managed to appoint someone to the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission who has said she can't imagine a case where gay rights wouldn't trump religious rights. Here's the point, folks. We Christians must never forget this. Freedom of religion is a fundamental human right precisely because we are made in God's image, and freedom itself is inherent in the very nature of God. God in his goodness gives us the freedom to follow him or not. Thus, freedom of religion is from God, not a gift from the Secretary of State or not a concession by government. No, no Secretary of State, no government has the right to take it or define it away. Make this point clear to your friends and associates while you still can. I'm Chuck Colson. That's this week's 2 Minute Warning.
Well, those are very strong words, and we placed a call to Chuck Colson to discuss his concern with us and to elaborate on it. He, of course, is the founder of Prison Fellowship and the author of many books that have had a great impact on Christian thought. Also with us by phone is Professor Robert George, who is a professor of jurisprudence at Princeton University and one of the most articulate defenders of the Christian faith in the world. And I'm delighted to have them both with us today. Chuck, let me go to you and ask you to elaborate on why there is that urgency that I detect and others do in what you had to say.
Well, Jim, thank you for doing this broadcast. I'm thrilled that we're going to be able to talk to your audience about this issue because it is absolutely fundamental. All other liberties depend on the freedom of religion. It's so basic, as Ryan said, it's why people came to this country in the first place, why people flee here today, where people take refuge here, because we are free to exercise our religious faith, which is entirely different than just worship. I first heard about this months ago, and I didn't do much about it because I thought maybe she just misspoke. And then I discovered that, no, she didn't misspeak. This is a specific policy of the Department of State that it is to treat the two terms interchangeably. It's never been said before. It's never been part of any policy before. Franklin Roosevelt once called the four freedoms and included the freedom of worship, but that was at a time when religious liberty wasn't even in. There was no threat to it whatsoever. Today, it is a very pregnant word and a very critical distinction. What I also discovered was that President Obama has used the term several times in speeches. Now, that's no coincidence. As Ryan pointed out correctly, I know, having been in the White House working with the president, you massage every single word in a speech. There's no word in there that's inadvertent. But there is a real concern on my part, a deep concern, that Christian people have got to understand this. I spoke about this. My pastor called me up Sunday ago in church to explain this to the people, and I did. I had more people come up to me afterwards and say, we never thought there was any difference between worship and religion. And a couple of people said to me, we heard your explanation, we're still not sure we understand it. I'm thinking to myself, we are going brain dead if we don't get this. This is really vital. This is the greatest threat to religious liberty in my lifetime, because it's Orwell. It's redefining the words, and we'll give new meaning to it. But the words of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights are very, very clear. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, that is, no state church, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, that means free exercise of religion, not just the right to worship in the privacy of my home.
Where do you think the president and the secretary want to take us with this? What's their end goal? What's the game being played here?
I hate to challenge anybody's motives, and I don't want to impugn anyone's motives, and I don't know for a fact, but I can only conclude that in the light of many other statements that have been made and the way in which they've treated the faith-based office and the way in which they've treated the International Commission on Religious Liberty, that they are downplaying the role of religion in public life. They are perfectly happy to have us worship, but they sure don't want us talking about abortion or homosexuality or gay rights or human rights issues. Look, at Hillary Clinton went to Beijing when she was the first lady, made a passionate speech on human rights, and minced no words. And now her first trip to China as Secretary of State, she never mentioned human rights. The issues they were concerned with were the environment and international economics and military questions, and she specifically ignored human rights. So what am I to say, make of all of this? They want to reduce religion simply to the privacy of our homes or our churches and keep us out of the public square. That's exactly, and that's what every person who has been a totalitarian or a statist, someone who believes in the central power of the state, has always tried to do this, because they're offended by the scandal of the Star of David and the scandal of the cross.
Mm. Professor George, thank you for joining us today, too. Are you also concerned about what some people would see as merely a shift in language?
Oh, yes, Jim. I'm deeply concerned about it. But I have to say that this does not surprise me. The Liberal Project, over many, many years now, has included what the great church state scholar at Notre Dame Law School, Professor Gerard Bradley, calls the privatization of religion. This is the idea that religion certainly should be tolerated, freedom of worship should be respected, the private practice of religion should be respected, but religion has no legitimate place in the public square, engaging with issues such as abortion and marriage. So the project really has been, and this is not something under the table, it's not something that liberal activists and scholars have hidden, they've been quite explicit that the project is to render religion an essentially private matter and to remove it from the public sphere. Let's, Jim, look at a couple of examples that I think will make clear the difference to your listeners. It's one thing to respect the right of Catholics to attend a mass, the right of Protestants to attend a worship service, the right of Jews to participate in a Seder in their homes and so forth. Those are regarded as private matters. But what about this? What about a Catholic or evangelical Protestant or Eastern Orthodox agency that assists with the placing of orphan children to adoptive parents? May a law such as the law in Massachusetts legitimately require them to place children in same-sex homosexual households or not? Now, I would argue, and people who believe in the public role of religion would argue, that no, the state should not be able to require religious organizations, Christian and other organizations, to violate their moral beliefs in that way. The folks on the other side think it's perfectly legitimate and no violation of anybody's rights to force those religious organizations to choose either to violate their conscience and place children in homosexual homes, or go out of business. Mm. Or take one more quick example, another real-life example. The example I just gave is real-life from Massachusetts. Here's a real-life example from New Mexico, an evangelical Protestant woman who has a little business as a wedding photographer, was asked by a same-sex couple to photograph their blessing ceremony. She very nicely, very respectfully explained that as a Bible-believing Christian, she could not perform that service. She could not participate in a same-sex blessing ceremony. It would violate her moral beliefs, her Christian moral beliefs. Well, she was reported to a state agency that imposed upon her a $7,500 fine for allegedly violating the civil rights code in the state, which forbids discrimination based on sexual orientation. In other words, that woman's freedom of worship may have been respected. She can still go to church on Sunday. She can pray in her home. But her right to live her faith and honor her own Christian moral beliefs was utterly taken away. She was deprived of that right. And the liberal movement seems perfectly content to have that be the case. In fact, they want to advance that agenda.
Mm-hmm. I really hope that our listeners heard within your words, both of you, that there appears to be a linkage between the change in wording from freedom of religion to freedom of worship to the homosexual agenda, and that is what's driving this change, this word game that's going on.
Jim, can I add something to that?
Yes.
It's not just the gay agenda, it's the abortion agenda as well. If I cited more examples, they would be examples of situations like this. Nine nurses on Long Island, working at a hospital on Long Island, who are disciplined by the hospital that they work for declining to participate in abortions because their Christian faith forbids them from taking part in the taking and the killing of innocent human beings. Now, these women stood up for their rights, they fought back, and they got their jobs back, and they also got an apology. But this just shows you that it is not simply the gay rights agenda, it's the abortion agenda as well. There are many, many people in this country on the liberal side of the fence who, in good faith, it's what they honestly believe that people should be forced either to participate in abortions or perform abortions if they're nurses or doctors or other healthcare workers, or go find another job. There's no respect offered to their religious consciences.
Jim, let me add one thing to what Robbie just said, because this ties in beautifully with what we're deeply involved in. This is why a year ago a lot of us got together and started writing and working on something that you, Jim, supported enthusiastically, original signers, called the Manhattan Declaration. You can get that at manhattandeclaration.org. But that's a statement in which we reaffirm our commitment to the three fundamental moral truths of society today, three fundamental moral issues: life, marriage, and liberty. And it concludes with words that may soon become very prophetic. When we say we will ungrudgingly render to Caesar what is Caesar's, but under no circumstances will we render to Caesar what is God's. And we're going to have to make that choice pretty soon. I think that's one of the reasons we wrote that document. It's one of the reasons 465,000 people have signed the Manhattan Declaration, and 65,000 signed a corresponding document in Britain. It's because around the world, I think people are waking up to the fact that if we don't take our stand, we are going to be run over quickly. We will be no better off than the Christians in China, mm-hmm. who can worship in the state church, but if they talk about any issue, they end up thrown in jail.
Chuck, you and I were talking last week about that, and you actually said to me that we might not have a great deal of time to defend the religious liberty that we've inherited from our founding fathers.
I don't think we do, Jim. I think that's why the Manhattan Declaration is so urgent. That's why I did this broadcast on my website, which, by the way, is colsoncenter.org, and people ought to go and see it and send it to their friends, because this is a wake-up call. Look, the Hastings case, the Hastings Law School case, which the Supreme Court just decided 5-4 against the Christian Legal Society's right to keep homosexuals out of positions of leadership. The deciding vote was cast by Justice Kennedy, our friend who appears in all the abortion cases for personal autonomy and defining life according to your own values. And what he says is, he very dismissively says, loyalty oaths are on the way out anyway. What is he really saying? If somebody believes that they are loyal to the Bible, loyal to God's teachings, that we can't make that oath, we can't live that? That is exactly the wedge point. And Robbie's right. It's not just over homosexual relations. It's over the whole sexual and personal autonomy issue. That's what's driven every one of these cases, going back into Roe versus Wade, the right of privacy implied in the Constitution. And you take every one of the major cases that have shifted the moral balance in this country from one that respected godly values to one that has become secular. Every single one is over the issue of sex and personal autonomy.
Jim, I'll just add to what Chuck said. The Hastings case, which is also known as the Martinez case, in that case, the Christian group whose right to restrict its membership to those who shared Christian beliefs and were willing to live up to the Christian moral code. In that case, the Christian group did not exclude people who happened to be homosexually oriented or experience same-sex attraction. anyone who was willing to live by the moral code, live by Christian biblical principles, regardless of their inward desires, was welcome to be a member of the group and indeed a leader of the group. So the only question was, will the group be entitled to insist that its members and its leaders actually live by the Christian faith, hold Christian beliefs? And there, shockingly, the court said that the university, state-sponsored law school, was within its rights in requiring that this Christian group admit, quote, all comers, even into leadership positions. So under this rule, they'd be forced to accept people who were atheists as leaders of the group, people who practiced sadomasochism or group sex or anything else. There could be no exclusions. Now, I don't see the risk, I think, quite as grave as it's sometimes made out to be. There will be real consequences, like people forced out of their professions, agencies, religious agencies forced out of business, religious institutions losing their accreditation, people subjected to monetary fines for violation of so-called non-discrimination rules. So there's a real threat to religious liberty here that we can acknowledge and rightly begin to combat, even if you share my view that we're not at the risk of what goes on in China or Korea.
You know, Professor George, it seems this is a one-way street. You know, you talked about the nine nurses being penalized for not participating in abortion, which is actually killing a life, but you'll have a high school sued if they pray before a football game, which is essentially somebody sitting and listening. If you don't want to listen, don't listen, but you're not being asked to kill somebody, and they're being penalized and fined for that. That seems egregious, in my opinion.
Ryan, you're absolutely right. Egregious is the right word. Chuck has already introduced some concepts from George Orwell. There was another English writer who we might invoke here. That's Lewis Carroll. Do you remember what happens in Lewis Carroll and Alice in Wonderland, his great work, when Alice goes through the looking glass? Everything is upside down and topsy-turvy and the reverse of what it should be. And to some extent, the courts and some other governmental institutions are taking us through the looking glass, where right is considered wrong and wrong is considered right. Up is down, down is up.
Martha Coakley, who lost her bid for the United States Senate when she ran for the Edward Kennedy seat, made this statement: you can have religious freedom, but you probably shouldn't work in emergency rooms.
Yeah. Right. That's what she said, because what did she want to do in emergency rooms? She wanted to force nurses to participate in abortions.
That's it.
Now that is a grotesque violation, not only of human rights, not only of the right to life, but of the human right we call freedom of religion, which shows that that right is not just freedom of worship. Freedom of worship is merely a fragment of the larger right of freedom of religion. That right must be respected in all its integrity, which means not simply the right in one's private affairs to express religious sentiments or to pray or to worship, but to act in the public sphere on one's religious beliefs. And Jim and Chuck, you know, and Ryan, this is part of our history as Americans. The abolitionist movement, the movement against slavery, was led by Christian believers who did not keep their faith in the closet, in the privacy of the closet, but took their faith into the public square. The civil rights movement was led by people like the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King and the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, men who took their religious faith into the public sphere in order to fight for what was just and right. And it's the same if we look at any other major reform movement in the history of our country. We would really be acting against our own best traditions in this country if we reduced freedom of religion merely to freedom of worship.
Well, Professor Robbie George from Princeton and Mr. Chuck Colson, the founder of Prison Fellowship, both of them authors, both of them speakers. You can see them on television often. They're out there on the front lines doing what's right. I appreciate you guys being with us today. The time went by so very, very quickly, and we're just not through. There's a lot more to say, and you both are so very, very busy. Maybe it's better to just continue talking right now, and we'll record it and let our listeners hear what we're about to say. Is that okay?
Absolutely, Jim. It's an honor to be with you all the time. I love it, and I appreciate the leadership you're taking.
We'll be in touch.
Thank you.
Man, Dad, that was amazing. We should do a lot more programs on issues like this.
We're going to do that, Ryan. I feel a spiritual obligation to do that, to let people know what we're facing as a nation, especially those who come from a Christian perspective and what they can do about it. Tell people how they can get in touch with us.
MyFamilyTalk.com is the website. We've got Chuck Colson's video. We have the Manhattan Declaration. You can read it, sign it. You can download it to give it to your friends. So we encourage you to come there. It's myfamilytalk.com. And don't forget to tune in tomorrow for part 2.